From the horizons of the unknown come transcribed tales from a thousand maybe worlds.
Time to talk comics.
I think Matt and I both agree about the issue.
I did not read it because I refused to read anything that you enjoy.
Oh my goodness, you got the boobs right.
It was monstrous. It was wrong.
I'm going to shoot She-Hulk.
No. You don't get to talk about Aquaman.
What?
No, it doesn't.
How would you know? Do you read it?
Hello, and welcome to the Off-Panel Podcast, the comic book show where the tensions are high and the ink is fresh. I'll be your host for this evening, Alex Cook, and joining me is Sergio Martinez.
What's up?
And Matt Dirty Southerner Johnson.
Oh, you really know how to turn my gears. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, you've been turning mine for so long, I figured I should return the favor.
You gave me a reach around.
Gosh, get your own Skype call, seriously.
You know you love it. Don't even hate. Don't even front.
I mean, we have entertained the possibility of a three-way, but I figured it would be
Dear
John.
God, no, not him. I don't make runs to the border. I'm sorry. No Speedy Gonzales.
Well, we'll have to see what Mercedes doing then.
There you go. That's more my speed.
She's our runner-up.
Yes.
So anyway, how was your guys' week?
Sergio, would you like to go first, or...?
I had a little bit of a disturbing day yesterday.
Oh, yeah, I remember this, yeah.
So I'm at work, I'm about to get some coffee, you know, just take a quick break, and this customer walks in that I know very well. I joke a lot with his son, you know, and this guy is like a grandfather figure to me in a way, you know? Old white guy. And I walk up to the door. I see this coming in, so I try to open it for him. He jokes, he pulls, so I'm pushing, he's pulling, so the door doesn't move at all, which is fine. You know, we joking around. Eventually, he lets go, and I push over for him. And then, you know how, like, you see in the movies where it's, like, two guys are joking, like, you know, like the fake box punching type of thing, you know?
Yeah, like,
you know, the fake boxing, yeah. Like, hey, oh, you rascally, you. Yeah, he does that. But instead of like closed fists, it's like open hand, and only his fingers are you know, wiggling, and like he rides up my chest and my nipple, because I'm turning during all this, and it's like incredibly awkward, and literally when he stops and walks by, I pause for a second, thinking, did that just happen? And then I walk out the door, and then I drink my coffee the entire time. My right nipple feels like his fingers are still there, and it's like I just
and forever your innocence was taken.
I'm like, oh, Mr. Lang, come on! It's like I was so awkward.
Sergio, can you point to us? Can you point to where on the Aquaman doll the man touched you, please? So that way we know for sure.
Here, yes.
But in his defense, though, it was Valentine's Day. So from the way it sounds, you had a much better Valentine's Day than me or Alex. So
you got physical contact. So
exactly. Like... Nice.
Bro fist.
Oh God. Yeah. And then American Jesus came in when I went to my comic book shop. My previous visit, I asked them to order me a copy of Volume 1. And so that came in, and I was happy, and I read it, and it was awesome.
You read it shaking, still horrified.
Still horrified. And so that was really awesome. It pisses me off because on the back cover, on the inside, it says, you know, Volume 2, you know, coming out fall 2009, and it never fucking came out. So here I am with the story, has an awesome one part, but I'm missing the rest of the trilogy because they apparently just stopped making – they didn't make it. I don't know. It's like my – cursed with Image Comics. I found Death Junior, it ends at Volume 2. You know, I find other things and they end before they're supposed to end, and it just makes me want to cry. Other than that, I got back some exam scores this week. You know, got all A's, so that's a good thing. Academically, my parents are proud. Me, I just don't give a shit. I mean, it was it was pretty easy to examine, to be honest. So other than that, yeah, that's about it, to be honest.
I would say something about you making good grades, but I forgot. That's the wrong racial stereotype, so I have to remember that.
You're kind of like in a blind spot now. You're like, oh, shit, what I come back with?
Yeah, well, I mean, you're Filipino, so that's close enough to being Asian. So you're like Asian mixed with Latino, so that's close enough. Mm. My week, nothing really of consequence.
You didn't get filled up?
Unfortunately, no. I tried. God knows I tried so bad. But I even stuck peanut butter to my shirt, walk around in front of the dogs. But no dice there. I'm just...
Your nipple lust goes unquenched.
Yes, exactly. But, yeah, business as usual for me this weekend. I assume the same would be your case, Mr. Cook.
Pretty much. I mean, I spent Valentine's Day, you know how most people spend it, you know, with their lovers or, in Sergio's case, with an elderly man. I spent it in a Skype chat with a couple friends. Pretty much. I mean, a couple of losers like me who like comic books. So.
So, hey, wait. You've been double timing on us. You bitch.
Oh, Matt wasn't there.
No.
You whore.
In fact, we do a whole other podcast. You don't know it. It's called the Panel Off Podcast. Not the most original name, but you know,
not even clever.
Secrets revealed. No. That's it. We are OPP. No more. I'm gonna throw my computer in the trash can.
Like Ron Swanson.
Yes. See, or I was thinking more like the Spider-Man analogy, but you know.
I think I saw a cover of Miles Morales having the classic, you know, cover from Spider-Man No More, but for Ultimate Spider-Man.
Ultimate Matt. He's no a black more. Child.
Shh, don't reveal my secret. My secret identity can never be known to the public.
He tosses his Klansman hood in the trash. No, his Black Panther attire.
No! How dare you stoop to that level, sir.
Well, you know. So, what about books?
Yeah, they're good to read, I guess. What about them? Did you have a point to make, or?
Well, I figured we'd take a bit of a deviation and talk about our favorite novels.
Okay. I only read books that have pictures in it. So yeah, my selection is very limited.
So it's either comic books or the Kama Sutra.
Well, hey, drawing is a drawing. If it can get you going, it can get you going.
Yeah.
That's your excuse for Aquaman.
Yours are old man fingers. I mean, look, it's not as bad as that one.
Oh yeah, it doesn't top the raging hard on.
Something about you, Sergio, you're just like mega gay bait. I don't know what it is.
I mean,
a dick magnet.
you're pretty much like apparently a very desirable man. I personally don't see it, but everyone in your area seems to see it.
Yeah, so I don't know what it is they're drinking down there in Texas, but...
A different type of Kool-Aid.
Yeah, I guess so. But yes, comic books.
Yeah, what are we looking at as far as ratio?
Ratio.
Mentioned to Alex before the show started that my list this week started off pretty good size, kind of long. But when I actually went to the comic shop and I flipped through, I was like, nope, not going to read it. So I'll read what I did end up pulling out. Mega Man number 2, Demon Knights number 17, The Manhattan Project number 9, Fantastic Four number 4 now, Uncanny X-Men number 1 now, The Standard number 1 now.
And now he's under Marvel
oh,
now.
Sorry. Oh, God. I got used to the dad part. And because
yeah, what you read was Standard New 52.
And because I knew you guys were gonna squeal like fangirls, I knew that I had to read at least this part of the chapter, the ending chapter, Batman number 17. That concludes my list. And I felt dirty because of it.
I think you're actually the only one that ended up reading the Standard this week, or did you read it?
No, I didn't read it. No, I didn't.
We don't care about John.
No. Yeah, I went into my comic book store and said, hey, let me get this book called The Standard. They're like, what? What are you talking about? I'm sorry. We have 16 different, you know, issues of Deadpool with, you know, 18 different covers, but we don't carry independent comic books, so fuck off.
Wait, to be safe, what I did, because, I mean, I have the original promo version, which is basically black and white that John was passing out at Comic-Con to different writers and such and publishers. So I have that, but I wanted to get the true release with the color and everything, you know. So I told my comic shop, hey, you know, can you check on your diamond list if there's a book coming out, because it's supposed to be available. And so I made sure like a month or two ago that they would order, you know, some standard copies.
Nice.
See, Sergio, that's what makes you a good friend. Alex and I, on the other hand.
Yeah, we suck.
We're bastards. We know it. I revel in my bastardry.
You're bastards for other reasons, though.
Well, Alex is. I know my father, unfortunately.
Gosh.
Believe me, I know my father well. But
That's a new one, I have to say. I've never been called that before. Not in that sense.
All right, well, my books for this week, I read The Manhattan Project's number 9, Wolverine and the X-Men 25, Fantastic Four number 4, Uncanny X-Men number 1, Fury Max number 9, Secret Avengers number 1, New Ghostbusters number 1, and I bought, but I did not read, Fatale number 12. Oh, and Batman number 17.
They relaunched Ghostbusters?
Yeah, well, like New Ghostbusters or something like that. Yeah. Well,
what I mean is, because I read IDW had a series. I read like the first 4 issues or so. Mm-hmm. So it could have only been at like issue like 9 or something max, and they relaunched it. That's weird.
I guess, I don't know. I saw it was the number 1, so you know, I jumped on. I've been a fan of Ghostbusters. So
interesting. What about you, Alex?
I read this week Death in the Family tie-in. At least I thought it was going to be, but ended up being not the case. Batgirl number 17, Batman number 17, Batman and Robin number 17, Bedlam number 4, Demon Knights number 17, Fantastic Four number 4, Secret Avengers number 1, Star Wars number 2, Uncanny X-Men number 1, and Wolverine the X-Men number 25.
So how was the Ghostbusters comic?
It wasn't bad. It was alright. Like, the whole premise of the book is that, the original 4 Ghostbusters, they get, banished to Limbo. So, they pick 4 new Ghostbusters to come join them. And these are people like...
Who banishes them, though?
They haven't really shown it yet. Yeah, like, it's kind of like Ghost showed up in Ghost Proton packs and, you know,
okay,
sort of like an opposite.
They got defeated.
Yeah. But
I'm gonna make a prediction. Mm-hmm. It's Viggo.
Viggo. Oh, I wish Viggo. I wish it was Viggo. The Scourge of Moldavia, the Sorrow of Carpathia, whatever he says. As long as Janusz is there. But anyway, you said something about the previous relaunch, and I assume that it's got to be tied to that, because the.
That would make sense, though. Then. If the story was that, then it makes some sense.
Yeah, because these new Ghostbusters are people who, they act like they've been, you know, they've interacted with the Ghostbusters in the past. They show you how they know them. Like, one of them is like an FBI agent that dates Venkman. Another one's like a friend of Ray, and another guy's like somebody who was trying to run around he had his own knockoff Ghostbuster team. But, yeah, it was decent. One thing I found interesting too was that it seems like it follows the continuity of the Ghostbusters game a little bit, because the character from the first Ghostbusters who shows up in the Ghostbusters game, Walter Peck, the guy that Bill Murray famously called Dickless, he was in the comic book, and he was in a role similar to what he was in the Ghostbusters game. So, I mean, it was all right. It wasn't bad. I'll definitely stick around for the next issue to see what comes of it. But, yeah, it was cool. The art was pretty decent. I do think that they did an all right job with the characters, getting the characters' voices right, the original Ghostbusters anyways. Bill Murray was kind of so-so, but just, you know, you can't really duplicate Bill Murray accurately, I don't think.
Yeah.
and have it be convincing. But other than that, yeah, it was pretty decent. And I'll, like I said, I'll definitely check it out next month when the second issue comes around.
Cool. All right, so I think we should start with not Batman number 17, but I think there's a much more important book that came out that Matt and I did not read, but Sergio, you said you read.
Yes.
So how
Mega
was
Man?
Was Mega Man?
Just Mega Man.
Dear God.
Actually, Mega Man was a pretty fun issue, to be honest. It was kind of cute. It was Valentine's themed in a way.
All right, we were talking about the Standard.
I'm getting to a more important book first. No, but and also just the Mega Man though was cool. Like, it wasn't your typical Valentine book. Like, it wasn't like, oh, you know, there's obviously decorations everywhere. It was just that you have these robots that have crush on each other and such. So it was a fun, good read. You know, definitely a filler issue, but there's still development. So if you guys have been a fan of the games and haven't read the comic, shame on you. Buy the freaking comic. Now onto the Standard. This is not my first time reading it. I've read the first two issues. I think that the first three issues have come out in the UK. I have the first two, one print from when I first met John, and then met him in person. And
yeah,
then,
San Diego Comic Con.
And then I had a second issue digitally off of this website that I bought it from when he had it released on a certain website. The cover is simply stunning. I think out of all the artwork I've seen of the Standard with Jonathan Richter, the covers he does is massive.
Yeah, I know the one with he's like up in the air with like his arms out, kind of like a Christ-like pose. Yeah, that was. I remember I saw like Jonathan Richter posted to Facebook. I was like, holy shit, that's like something, you can't even get like mainstream comic book covers looking that good, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I personally love the one that, I don't know if it's a variant cover for the first issue or maybe it's a cover to the one of the other issues, but it's him shielding a little, like he's shielding a little girl from something exploding or something. Oh. And it's just, the dynamics of that is just beautiful.
My favorite issue that I've seen so far is issue number 2 cover, though. Obviously, we're talking about issue 1. So, yeah, one thing that I do recall when we had Jonathan Richter on the show is that the first, like, issue and a half or first two issues, he was still experimenting with how he wanted to handle some of the art because there's, like, flashback scenes and such. And it's more so, I believe, in the second issue or the end of the second issue that his inking style changes for the better, in my opinion. So, other than that, visually, it's still an awesome book. I really love Jonathan Richter's art. Just that he mentioned how he was trying to mix different styles in before he ended up going with, like, his true style is what you see on the cover. So it's my understanding that I'm trying to recall if it's either part of issue 2 or in issue 3 is when he goes full blown that style, and it's beautiful, like really nice. And as for the writing, since John's obviously the writer and John's on the show, and you know, this book's finally out in the U.S. One of the most charming characters is essentially I want to say that it's John if John was an agent for a superhero. So
I know. I saw like the preview for the first issue, and that character really caught my attention.
Yes, yeah, so there's a Scottish agent because the current guy that's the Standard. He's kind of like, I think like Booster Gold in that he's, you know, doing endorsements and such, and he has an agent. And the agent, like, when he's talking, I picture John's voice, and John used some of his lingo that we've all used in jokes, you know, like ball bag and shit, you know?
Yeah.
But issue 1 is extremely strong for an issue because here is an indie book, you know, here's a new publisher. And grabbing new readers is not easy. You have to really hook them for the first issue. And, you know, I'm not trying to toot John's horn because he's a buddy and he's on the show. This literally is a really good, legitimate first issue. Like, it's gotten good reviews in the past when it came out in the UK, and it has recently. And it's well-deserved. This is a really good issue, number 1. Like, it is very intriguing. It hooks you. You fall in love with certain characters. there's moments where there's flashbacks of the original standard, and John purposely has like a Silver Age feel to it with the dialogue and such. And I think what's most impressive is that the current standard, you think at first, oh, he's kind of like a jerk because he's doing this for money and for endorsements. But then you see all his regrets. You see how he truly feels about things. And he's like devastated about this one case that he hasn't closed yet, basically. And so it's also a heartfelt issue, especially with the end. So definitely recommend it.
Of course.
Not just to help out John, but when all six issues come out, I'll definitely want to get the trade also. The cover, Jonathan Rector, you know, I see him every single day on Facebook doing sketches or commissions or posting new shit. Like, his style is simply stunning, and it's perfect for this book. So, in all honesty, I would pay money for a reprint if he was to redraw the first issue, just because – not because it's bad. It's simply because I recall him saying that he was experimenting with how he wanted to tackle some of the scripts. So, because of that, I feel like if he was to redo it in his regular style, I would buy double the price for that, because it would just be beautiful. Like, when you look at the cover of this book, you don't think that it's an indie book. I'm not trying to diss indie books, but there are some that I've seen at conventions where it's like it downright is definitely a self-published book. This thing looks like a professional book. You look at the cover, you're like, wow, this is actually really, really nicely done.
I know. So, and the coloring, too. I mean, that's really what makes it pop.
Mm-hmm. The color on the cover is really nice, especially, yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, all listeners out there, you know, get the standard number one. I think John posted them on Facebook that Diamond sold out for what they were for the volume that they were allowing or something, which is good for John, but also not great for all the fans. But because it's through Diamond, you can ask your shops, nearby local shops, to order it for you. If they're a shop that, you know, is cool and legit, they should have no issue, because, you know, they're allowed to order from Diamond. My shop, you know, they'll buy one copy of a book if they know that I'll buy it. So hopefully, you know, other shops are just as good. Some shops, it wouldn't surprise me too much if they require, you know, oh, well, I can't order because I have to order at least like five or something, you know. That would suck, you know, if they don't want to do it because of that. But it's definitely a very good book.
Yeah, and I think also you can purchase it digitally if you can't manage to get like your hands on a physical copy. I'll probably look for the link for the site and put it in the show notes.
I know you can also – I think you can also buy it directly from Comics Tribe site. That's the name of John's publisher from
Standard. Yeah, Comics Tribe with an X.
Yeah, because I was looking the other day. I was thinking about maybe trying to get the issues they have with Standard and try to get Scam to check that out. So I think that'd be good to see. Read both
those. Yeah, it would be awesome if this was on Comixology, because then you guys could have gotten it a little bit easier. But obviously, you know, them getting into Diamond was a very big step. So hopefully they can get into Comixology too, so they can get into that part of the digital market as well.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
But, I mean, to be honest, it's like, I don't think any of us were surprised that it was well written, because we've known John for so many years. Like, even before he wrote comic books, we'd seen his writing on basically a weekly basis.
Yeah.
And he was always like one of the most impressive, probably the most impressive that I've ever seen, as far as like someone just writing for fun. And
yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'm honestly pretty dismayed that I couldn't get a copy of it, because I'm from the looks of it, it looks like a pretty good book. So yeah, mm-hmm. I definitely second your recommendation, even without reading it.
All right. So, Demon Knights number 17. I felt like I was waiting forever for this book because I really wanted it to come out faster, even though it came out on regular time.
Yeah. I got it.
Nah, I didn't.
I don't think.
You did. You drop it, Matt, because of the new creative team, or
I was starting to lose interest in it, and then when they announced Cornell was leaving, I was like, there's probably really no point in getting it, because, you know, he's leaving it, and it's not been selling that good, so I figured it probably won't be too long before it gets canceled. But, you know, that's just me being pessimist that I am, so.
Yeah,
Yeah, I legitimately hope it doesn't, because this book has so much potential, I think. Like, what did you think of this issue, Sergio?
I liked that we saw we found out more so, you know, how Jason, you know, is basically a mute right now.
Yeah.
And that was a good part, because I was like, oh man, I wonder what possible twisted thing Vandal Savage did to him. This is not, you know, out of all the things you can think of, this is not the worst, but it still works, you know, for the setting of the time period, and, you know, knowing the title, it works.
Yeah, and it's a believable motivation too.
Yeah.
So.
And it was probably one of the best moments, because one thing that I was concerned about is that, you know, oh, with Cornell leaving, we'll have the same humor and charm. And, you know, there's definitely moments that capture that. My favorite moment in the issue is when they're escaping, and literally the horsewoman basically says to the horses, you know, don't ride at all. And Vandal Savage hops on his horse, and they all just dropped it. All the horses just, like, lay down. And he's like, damn you, horsewoman!
I know, Vandal Savage continues to be the best character in this book, I think.
Yeah.
Just his portrayal, it's like, it's nothing like the Vandal Savage of, like, the current DCU. I don't even know, like, when they're going to tackle him.
He appeared
briefly in the DC Universe Prevents arc. One of them.
Oh, yeah.
It was more serious. It wasn't really as fun. Yeah, he was more like a serial killer or some bull crap. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, just any Vandal Savage from the previous stories and anything. It's like, this is a completely new take, but it works so well because I think the character is just so despicably charming for some reason. Yeah. But it's good to see that the new writer keeps up with that, because I was a little concerned. Like, one of the things that I'm kind of worried about is that we're seeing more of the horsewoman. Like, we're seeing more of her personality, and I'm kind of worried at the same time that she'll lose a lot of the charm that Cornell...
Yeah, because her thing kind of was mystery in a way. Like, that was kind of an appeal to it.
Yeah.
Like, we all had ideas of, you know, what she was about. I'm not too off-put by it, but I can definitely see the concern.
Yeah, yeah, and, I mean, the rest of it I thought was pretty good. I mean, I don't know about Xanadu. Like I'm curious to see how she's going to fit in it all.
Yeah, that ending shot, it didn't upset me, but I was kind of like, oh, you know, the same gang is back together. But it's not terrible, but I don't know, like, maybe I'm just not as much of a fan of Xanadu as I thought I'd be.
Perhaps. Yeah, yeah, probably. I mean, it was cool to see Etrigan in that beginning.
That was one of my favorite scenes, because the last issues that Cornell did do, he made me fall in love with Lucifer. I love Lucifer in this comic, and that was a good treat seeing him torment, you know, Etrigan verbally. With his trolling, basically. He basically trolls him constantly. It's awesome. Also, what made me smile was how when Exorcistos, or how do you pronounce her name?
Exorcistos, I think.
Exorcistos, when she shows up to save to Vandal, to approach him, like, they don't contest by, like, having a real fight. It's an arm wrestle. And that was an awesome moment. It was so Vandal Savage. It's like, what's arm wrestle? Like, I loved that so much.
Yeah. I'm glad the new writer definitely gets a handle on Vandal Savage, because that could have broken the book.
Yeah. And it's nice that, you know, even though we have a new writer, and even though Bernard Chang was not the original artist, he was the recent artist. So the transition, you know, is smoother because of that.
Yeah. Definitely. So I'm sticking with it, definitely.
Yeah, definitely.
So
Matt, you can go to hell.
Yeah, so I was saying, good to see that you spent.
You can burn hell.
No, damn you, Martinez. it's good to see you spent 5 minutes pretty much spitting in my face of my comments. So there's the fire.
It's your own fault.
I've tasted my own in medicine, sir, and it is bitter. It is bitter indeed.
Well, how about we switch things around then? You and I read a book this week. Well, Sergio also read it, but
He doesn't count. So
yeah, Yeah, I forgot about him.
As I
often do.
Only legal U.S. citizens can talk about this book. Sorry.
So, Batman number 17.
Yes, Batman number 17.
The last part of The Death of Family.
Yes.
Now, I think something we should get out of the way for... Okay. This book, this arc for a very long time was building towards what many believed to be a certain resolution.
Yes.
And that resolution did not come to pass. Now,
yes.
I'm not saying it's a bad thing that it didn't come to pass, but at the same time, we should probably get it out there that no, Alfred does not die.
No. Yeah, I thought maybe you were leading to something else, but yeah, I forgot about the whole Alfred thing. Yeah, Alfred is alive and well.
Yeah. Alfred, I mean, that was basically the big rumor throughout the entire arc, because the first issue of the arc ends with Joker kidnapping Alfred, and I think, like, the next issue has him recorded torturing in Wayne Manor, so...
Yeah, that's right. He supposedly, like, throws bleach in Alfred's eyes or something.
Yeah, ammonia.
Yeah.
So, that said, though, I think it was a pretty well-written arc.
I thought...
I think it was better than Court of Owls, for sure.
The resolution's better than Court of Owls. The ending is better than Court of Owls,
of course. Well, to me, personally, that wasn't too hard to top. Just, you know, the Court of Owls
but
left such
pulls, a... He pulls very similar cards, though.
Yeah, he does. And I do think that maybe it's just because the Joker is a character that's been around so long, has been so ingrained into the Batman mythos. It's more easier to accept him... And as being, you know, a character, kind of like what he does, is more acceptable maybe because it's the Joker compared to someone like Lincoln March who just showed up like six issues earlier and, you know, just.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's get it out of the way. Joker isn't Bruce's brother. Just before
he's Joker?
His father.
My
he's
brother?
His
dun, dun, dun.
He takes a... This was crazy. I saw like a rumor online before the issue came out that people were thinking that Joker was going to take off his face and end up being someone else.
Huh. That'd
like,
be kind of interesting.
Maybe, I didn't get that.
I never thought about that. But, you know, like people were – I do think that probably one of the best parts, even though I knew it was going to be a cop-out, even though I kind of wish it wouldn't, was the reveal of what exactly was under those platters, you know?
Yeah.
I thought that was sick and pretty cool.
Yeah, and when I read that page, like – Honestly, I was dreading reading that page. Like, I legitimately kind of got fevered when I was turning the page because it's like, oh, God, this is it. This is going to be Alfred's head or something like that. And I turned the page and it's like, oh, holy crap.
It's even worse. It appeared to be even worse, to be honest.
Yeah. Basically, Nightwing, Robin, Red Robin, and Batgirl's faces appear taken off and put in ice.
Yes.
Yeah. Which was a pretty gruesome image, but at the same time, I kind of suspected, well, okay, let's say this is true. They're probably going to fix it with, like, an easy surgery or something
I was looking forward to seeing, like, for the next few months in the Bat books, having them run around with, like, belts around their heads like Joker is now, watching as their facial skin gets all crusty and, you know, dried up from exposure.
That would be so
awesome. I'm sorry. I just think it would be cool.
I mean, it would have been a step up for Teen Titans with him. So
that's not so much.
But no, that it ends up being a cop out, which I'm kind of mixed on. It's like at the same time, it fits the character of the Joker.
Yeah.
Like,
oh no, I'm glad it was a cop out because I was kind of mad when I saw it. I was like, you gotta be kidding me because I mentioned that, you know, one turn off is that this is a little too dark for me in a way for Joker.
Yeah.
The main turnoff being that people are like overly blowing some stuff in this book, so that's why I didn't want to read it as much. But like when I sat down and read it, I was like, no, that better be a fucking, like, you know, trick, and I was happy that it was
because
that really annoyed me.
Because at the same time, it is very much a Joker really move to basically make it an elaborate joke to, you know, damage Batman psychologically rather than damage it, like, anyone around him physically. Like,
yeah, and that's the whole point. It's a psychological thing.
Yeah.
Not like a actual, like, oh, yeah, I want to literally kill everyone around you so you can feel pain. Like, it's like, oh, no, they're alive, but, you know, I'm going to do whatever I can to make you wish that they were dead, because like, it would be less painful.
Yeah, pretty much. And I was reading an interview with Snyder about this issue, and he said, yeah, that from the beginning was pretty much what the entire point of the arc was Joker was trying to prove a point to Batman. He wasn't trying to, you know, take out another one of his sidekicks and, you know, oh, you're going to grieve over this one, just like you grieved over Jason Todd.
Which... And if you see, you know, with, I love, like, the last few pages of the issue because it shows you that, you know, at the end of the day, Joker succeeded. You know, there is maybe not a death of the family, but there's but definitely, there's a distance between them. Yeah. And one other thing I love, too, was the reveal of how the whole stuff with the card, because, you know, they were implied that from the beginning that he knew who Bruce Wayne was.
Yeah.
And
not only that, but that's been a long-standing point of contention between a lot of fans. Like, people have had this theory that he knows exactly who Batman is. He just doesn't want to – he just doesn't care because that's not really the part of him that he's concerned with.
Yeah, you know? And I do think that, you know, for them to acknowledge that and to accept that, to me, it works because, you know, like the issue says, like you just said, you know, kind of like in Joker's mind, he's built up a fantasy. Yeah. Of Batman, who Batman is, and Bruce Wayne doesn't equate into that fantasy at all.
Yeah,
and it, and just... yeah, if he knew his identity, what would be the fun of it? You know, like he attacked Alfred, but you know, like you said, it wouldn't kill him. He doesn't. Yeah. He has no use for Bruce Wayne. You know.
Yeah, none at all. Like that was actually a really brilliant fact of the story was that at one point Batman has Joker. And he's taunting him with the idea that maybe he does know who Joker's real name was.
Yeah.
Like, he knows who he was before he became the Joker. And Joker is so horrified by this that he stops him mid-sentence and ends up causing, you know, basically his own quote-unquote death, which, you know, we know will be back. But at the same time, I thought that was a really interesting scene because it's like, it's not so much the Joker doesn't care. He's frightened of knowing, of acknowledging what he already knows, because that means the joke is over. That means he has no reason to go on.
Yeah, exactly.
I thought that was a really good character moment. So,
I was kind of bothered only because, you know, I have no problem if it happened at one point and then the face healed up. But you guys notice how in the flashback scene where they show Bruce approaching the Joker in the cell, Joker has the scars on his face.
Yeah,
I didn't catch that. No, I didn't notice it.
Yeah, I really didn't like that personally, because this is supposed to be like the early career. Like, this is because he says that, oh, I've visited the Joker pretty much around the time when I first brought Dick in. So this is like his early career still, in a way.
Yeah.
So that kind of bugs that Joker's face was scarred earlier versus, you know.
Yeah, I actually kind of didn't get why that was, because I mean, I know it's a relaunch and it's a reboot of continuity, but at the same time, it's like we've seen the Joker in flashbacks in the New 52, and he doesn't really have the scarred smile. So I was like, well, why is that there? Like, it's just been – and not only that, but it's kind of been a change that I've been like, that's a little too Heath Ledger-ish for me.
Yeah, I know.
So, I mean
– like. I was against it when I saw the first clip, the first photo of Heath Ledger as Joker, but it worked in the movie and it worked with how he played and it fit. But for the comics, I just don't want that scarred face Joker. I just don't.
And like to bring up what you said, like I'm flipping through it just now while y'all were talking, and I looked at the scene. I see he has the scars, and then you see a few pages later where Batman's looking on a computer with Joker's mugshot, and it's classic Joker with no scars. You know?
Yeah.
So even the inside the book itself is not too consistent.
Yeah.
With the portrayal of Joker, but in looking through it, what were you saying?
I mean, I guess it's really not a big deal considering now his face is gone, and I assume eventually when the Joker returns, he'll have like some plastic surgery done to restore his face, and he'll be the classic Joker we know and love. At least I hope. Like, I hope this isn't excuse for them to go, well, now he has the Heath Ledger look, because I don't really want that for the comics.
And I know it's maybe unrealistic, but I would like them to keep the rotten, scabbed over, you know, face. To me, then, like we mentioned, that art from, was it 15? To me, something about that is much more scary than the Joker that we've become accustomed to. over the years.
Yeah. I wouldn't mind that. Like, I wouldn't mind that being sort of a permanent thing where he, like, maybe he has, like, a new face every time he shows up or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, they could play around with that pretty good, so. But, yeah, this are definitely better than Corvallis as far as, like, at least overall, I think. Corvallis definitely had, like, a lot more to it.
So the setup.
Yeah. And that, you know, it was like, 12 issues, obviously, where this was, like, 6 or 7.
Well, I think maybe it benefited
from a this short arc.
No, not just shorter, but also with the fact that it's Joker. No setup required. There's no need to build up his status as a threat or to establish that, like you had to do with the Court of Owls.
Though, I mean, Snyder kind of did do that at one point. Like Sergio was saying, it does share a lot of the same kind of plot things, and one of the things that kind of reminded me of Court of Owls was when he found the card, like establishing something from Bruce's past that wasn't already there, so.
Sure. But, to me, this was definitely, if not on par with Black Mirror, but, like, right up there with it, in terms of, like, my favorite that Snyder's done so far, so.
Yeah.
And there's that interview that I think Alex and I read the same interview where Snyder is planning, like, after, like, there's going to be, like, 4 issues of just, just story, and then there's going to be another huge, huge story arc, apparently, and he's saying it's going to be even bigger.
Yeah, apparently this story arc is the one he's been building to because it's about something that he said was very close to his heart, like something to deal with fatherhood, which I guess comes into play, which, I mean, I'm not going to say it because it hasn't 100% happened yet, but, the big rumor is that Damian's going to be killed off in Batman Incorporated.
Yeah, I saw those rumors too.
Well, and as long as Thomas Wayne does come back from the dead. Anytime he says something about fatherhood, that's what I think about fatherhood and Batman.
I hope not. That's been dangled over our heads since Morrison did R.I.P. and yeah, hopefully not. But Batman number 17. I liked it.
Would you say it was pretty neat?
Yeah, pretty neat. Pretty neat. Crocheted bat. 5 crocheted bat cowls out of 5.
And the ideal rating is 1,700 crocheted bat cows.
Out of 57.
Out of 57, exactly. So, it was good. That was quality right there.
Yeah. So, what about a book you want to mention, Matt?
Huh. Let me think.
There has to be only one.
What came out this week that I would like to talk about? Let me think.
My Little Pony.
Man, for once I'm glad John wasn't on. Because now you have nothing.
Projects. Sir, I got the Manhattan Projects.
I read it.
Yeah, sir, you read it. So I guess I'm wrong about that.
I got my Cholo over here backing me up. So
you have foiled me again.
That's right.
Damn you.
In your face, Cook. Burn in hell, Cook. Or burn in nothing, because the Jehovah's Witnesses don't believe in the hell. But rest in moderate comfort in your grave.
Just talk about your damn
comic. I don't know. There's not a whole lot to say, really, about this. It was a follow-up from the previous issue of the Manhattan Projects, where the Illuminati, the people who control the world, go to war with the Manhattan Projects. Me being a slight stickler for history, there was another historical inaccuracy I noticed. This one, not too big.
I really liked it, to be honest. I really liked that part, though.
I did like, I think that's just another thing with me having to accept this is alternate history. Obviously, with the fact that there's robot Nazis walking around now at this point. But, so pretty much, for those not in the know, like I said, the previous issue was about the Illuminati trying to destroy the Manhattan Projects, and they managed to fend them off, and in this issue, they fight back, which there's a lot of awesome moments, with you see, like, the way that they kill the Mexican luchador. Einstein and Feynman, they kick him out of Einstein's, like, teleport door. And then the two generals, the American and the Russian, the way they killed those guys inside his office was pretty awesome, too. They essentially burned him to death. But, like, this issue ends with, I'm already forgetting, but I know. Did they kill Truman, or did they just throw him out of office?
Oppenheimer says, I'm not gonna kill you. I'm gonna eat you.
And then
you see Truman screaming.
Yeah. So yeah, apparently in this world, Harry Truman was eaten to death by J. Robert Oppenheimer.
Makes sense.
And then they bring the. But my highlight was the history altering part that John. That Matt.
How dare you, sir?
I compared it to a Scotsman.
The ultimate fate.
I think that out of all the history alteration, aside from the hilarious Truman orgies, I think this is actually my favorite thing. The whole how they bring JFK into it, and how they kind of, you know, the whole fact that they have all this crazy technology, but they justify the reason. They make a reason why the space race still was valid, you know, in history.
Yeah.
How is it basically them covering up because now they can do it whatever the hell they want.
Yeah, they're using like JFK as their puppet, you know, and through the space race, you know, like you said, they can pretty much do whatever they want to. But
yeah, because they have all the technology in the world, but they're acting like they don't.
Yeah.
It's very awesome.
Yeah. And the only thing the stickler that I talked about was historically accurate was that Truman was president, and then after Truman was president, you had 8 entire years of Dwight Eisenhower. Then you got to Kennedy. That was the only thing.
Oh, okay, that part.
Because they skipped the whole president, you know, with 2 terms. I mean, I understand Kennedy's more popular and more well known, but I don't know. That was just me being.
We like Ike.
Yeah, I like Ike anyway. But yeah, I also like that that part where they're watching on TV that famous Kennedy speech, you know, that he talks about going to the moon and how, you know, mankind, you know, we choose to go to the moon not because it is easy, but because it's hard. And they cut to like the scientists watching and like Feynman, he says, you know, I wrote that. And it's just a nice little moment it just shows you just how much in control he is, you know, or how they have him. So
yeah, I think out of all the Illuminati-esque type of characters I've seen in any comics, you know, story like Marvel's, DC's is the what's it called, the quintessence, which is rarely used. Marvel's is the Illuminati, and then here you have the Manhattan Project. I think that this one tackles the concept the best. Granted, New Avengers is doing a lot of good stuff with the Illuminati, where they're showing you, they're not just telling, they're showing you.
Yeah.
But Manhattan Project, it's like holy crap, they literally show you in awesome detail and an explanation how these guys are literally shaping the world.
Exactly. And really I awesome. Think one of the things that brings it so much farther at home is that, yes, it's a comic book, and yes, it's, you know, alternate, very different. But still, this is a world, for the most part, you take away the robot arm Nazi scientists and the talking dogs and the, you know, the orgies with the president, you know, in the White House. It's a world not too far, you know, from our own world. And I think that's maybe it's a little more believable. I don't know. Believable as in maybe more plausible. I don't know.
Yeah, it has so many elements that are realistic mixed with some fantasy that it is like you can accept it.
Yeah. But read it if you haven't already. Damn you, Cook. Read it. Read it now.
Well, I mean, I don't know if I can read it in good conscience because of the historical inaccuracy.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Right. You know, you watch a few documentaries on World War II and suddenly you're an expert.
Well, recently, because obviously Comixology, after like a month or so, typically it's a month, the previous issues go down $1. The first 8 issues are all $1.99 versus the usual price of $2.99, so...
Maybe this is another image. I know they had a few image books that were the number ones for free. I don't think Manhattan Projects was one.
Oh yeah, this one, issue one is for free.
Oh, so, yeah. Nice.
Get to it.
Well, I mean, I've read issue one, so.
Oh, well, look at you, fancy, fancy man.
Yeah, with my reading ability. All right. So, what about you, Serge?
I feel obligated to mention Uncanny X-Men But it wasn't bad, but I don't feel that it needs any praise. However, this is the book that I was saying before the show started that for once I kind of tolerated slash kind of liked Butch Hallow's art.
You know, it's weird. I kind of agree with you.
Yeah, he didn't do anything different, but it's like the scenes that were called for in the script, the coloring, for some reason it kind of worked for me. I don't know why.
Yeah, I don't get it either, because I'm really not a fan of Bacciallo's art. Like, when he was doing Wolverine the X-Men, I tolerated it because of Jason Aaron's good writing of the book, but at the same time, I was like, man, I wish a different artist was on this, and luckily I got my wish. But with this one, it's like, I guess maybe it's the characters?
Like, maybe it's it could be a combination of, like, the characters, the tone, and also the coloring. You know, because sometimes a colorist can really change like how art is perceived. You know, I was thinking about that some other books I read this week, but yeah, I know what you're saying though about how it didn't seem as bad. I noticed that because I was really kind of dreading reading it just based on the art.
Yeah,
it's kind of like most of the pages had like a certain like gradient filter. You know, it's like. It kind of has like a certain trend of like lots of like purples and yellows and oranges, but like in the blues, but like in a way that works. Yeah. Although I was kind of confused why it looks like Magneto's new costume is like white and black.
Yeah.
But
I think it looks kind of like there's like the Age of Apocalypse Magneto. The only reason I remember that is because I used to play like the X-Men video game and I played with that character, but I wonder if it's a redesign, because you seen in the book, there's a few characters that got redesigned, especially Cyclops. I think that X on his face is fucking stupid, but that's just me, maybe, or maybe not me. But I don't know if it's just a redesign or if that's the way he draws Magneto. It could just be that, because I've seen artists, doesn't matter, you know, what one guy is doing, you know, another artist will draw the character the way they want to draw him.
There's a cover of Indestructible Hulk coming out soon, like issue 7, where you have Hulk with his current stupid looking pants, and then you have classic Thor next to him. It's like, what? This classic looking Thor. It's like, what the hell? So it could be that too. Yeah. So yeah, the book isn't bad. It's just that I don't feel that it was so awesome that it deserved much praise. Like, it wasn't bad, but I think out of all the characters, my favorite character is Tempest, the one that can make that whole time and space bubble.
Yeah.
But I can't say that, like, this is an amazing book. I'm also reading it because I'm reading all new X-Men.
One thing that I kind of got confused about was the character who's supposed to be the healer character.
He looked like a girl, but it's supposed to be a boy.
Yeah, like in – I've only seen him in a few issues. Like, he was in All New X-Men #1. But he looked kind of like he was Asian, vaguely Asian or something, or Middle Eastern.
In his first appearance,
and now he's, like, black and got an afro. I didn't get that, unless I was reading it wrong.
I have to go back and check for that.
I don't know. I think maybe – if that's the case, this Bacciallo guy really is reinterpreting characters how he wants to.
Yeah, if that is the case, yeah.
I pretty much agree with the two of you. I mean, it wasn't bad by any stretch of the imagination. It's just, I can't see myself remembering this, like, months down the line. Whereas, like, I remember the first issue of All New X-Men and the first few issues of Wolverine the X-Men, definitely.
Yeah, and I do want to say that, I don't know, you know, I know that given Bendis, the book is kind of all new experience was like the flagship titles of the X-Books, but you know, I kind of wish that maybe Glenn was still on this book.
I really love Kieran Glenn's Uncanny X-Men run, I would have been thrilled with that, but you know, what can you do?
Exactly. Take it. That's what we have to do. And it was just good because, you know, Alex, you're good at taking it.
You should know.
I'm good at giving
it. You know, another thing that I noticed is that Bacciallo draws the way that Tempest's powers work differently, in a way. Like, I recall an issue of All in the X-Men where it is a bubble, but the first time that she uses it, I just checked, it's not a bubble. It's more like it looks like a bunch of, like, static fields of electricity, kind of. But minor nitpick, but then again, I do recall at one point where where she uses the power and is a bubble, I think.
I was going to say, because I think we've only seen her use it, like, what, twice so far, including this issue, so, I mean, you know.
Yeah, it could vary based off of, you know, potency or something.
Yeah,
so.
How well she's controlling it.
Yeah, which they say in the book that she managed to master it in a matter of, what, days or something?
Yeah, that's what they said. Yeah.
So, yeah. No pretty needs for this one.
Okay, I just found the black kid. He was black, but the afro was much more tame.
Okay.
But Charlo made his own twist to it, because his afro was, like, insane. And
he is like
Uncanny X-Men,
like undercover brother style afro.
Yeah.
Uncanny X-Men.
So that clears that up.
What else?
Did you enjoy Fantastic Four?
Yeah. This one wasn't bad.
It wasn't bad. It just felt like a filler issue, but not in a bad way. It had some good moments. I don't know how I feel about Reed being the one that drew the cave painting, though.
Well, I kind of had a feeling something like that was coming, just because of the fact that...
It was so exact.
It was so exact and so detailed, yeah. But, I mean, it was kind of interesting. It was kind of heartfelt. I wouldn't say too heartfelt, but...
It felt like they were trying to do a Valentine's issue without saying that it was a Valentine's.
Yeah, I know.
The issue itself definitely focused on Reed and Sue and their relationship, so.
But I do think that maybe it does, you say it's a bit of a filler, but I do think they kind of, by the end of the issue, it kind of finds its place in the overall story with, it seems like next issue Reed's going to tell her that, you know, he's dying or whatever it is that's wrong with him, so. I think maybe it served its purpose for the grand scheme of things. But one thing I felt like was a little bit of a retread of the previous run that Hickman did was although they didn't go into much detail with it, which I was glad, was the whole aliens kind of worshiping Sue as like a queen or a god or whatever. That happened in an issue of Hickman's run with a bunch of underwater people who looked a whole lot like these guys in this issue, but that was just one thing. And one thing, too, is I don't know if it bugs y'all as much as it bugs me, but something about the way Franklin Richards is being written kind of irks me a little bit.
Yeah,
yeah,
I know
so,
too.
He seems too childish.
Yeah.
And not only that, but he seems too close to Valeria.
Yeah. Are you talking about, like, an age?
Yeah, an age.
Yeah,
like, just in maturity.
Yeah,
if
some of the previous stuff, they've established that she is, you know, she's supposed to be super smart, genius kind of level. She's supposed to be like as smart as Reed at this point.
Yeah, she's supposed to be more mature and such. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but I can accept that. But yeah, I don't know. It just feels like it's kind of a regression from where he was.
Yeah, like Franklin's supposed to be like silly, goofy, not like I want my mommy.
Yeah, he's kind of a bit of a mama's boy, but
Yeah, because like I mean, one of the best issues that I've read in comics in a while was one of the last issues of FF where the future of Franklin Richards is like, all right, okay, you know, we're gonna go into our special world and do whatever you want. Like, he's like, we're gonna do all the things that you wrote down that you wanted to do, and that was one of the best issues ever. And it was Franklin just being very creative, imaginative, and goofy, and that's the Franklin Richards that I like.
Yeah.
But this is like, seriously, it's like every second I want my mommy. It's like, okay.
And I get you know, the whole story, he had a bad dream, you know.
Yeah.
And I understand him being kind of like, you know, scared or whatever. But I just noticed that previous issues were kind of like that too. And this issue just kind of stuck out more to me than it did previously.
I am glad about one thing, and that Ben, you know, the thing, didn't say the word that Fraction's been kind of over.
Yeah,
his
keyword. Yeah, I know what you mean.
So I was glad about that, because that just seemed to be getting annoying.
That's something reading. I noticed, like that's happened in Fantastic Four and FF a little bit, and also Hawkeye. Whereas in Hawkeye the keyword's bro, and in this one it's dummy. So I don't know what it is. Maybe he likes having, like, you know, certain words he likes to use. I don't know.
I think what I feel like when I was reading this issue and some of the past issues is, like, I think, especially because I think Johnny, now granted, Johnny's always been humorous, but, you know, I feel like he's trying to capture some of the traits that people loved when they first were introduced in a way. I don't know. To me, Johnny pulling that prank in this issue felt out of nowhere and kind of like dumb. But it's obviously, you know, he was a thing that he did a lot in the 70s and such. He would pull pranks on the thing, so it fits. But it just feels like he's trying to recapture these moments, and I feel like it's not needed at all.
Yeah, I've noticed that seems to happen with writers when they take over Fantastic Four. Like, over the course of running, Johnny will go from being immature, you know, kind of a ladies' man, to being thoughtful, caring, and responsible. And then the next writer will come in and just wipe that all away, you know. He's right back to square one, pretty much, is how. It doesn't matter. You know, pretty much he fits whoever's writing him, his needs at the time, so.
You read a lot of Fantastic Four. I think it's pretty safe to say. Like,
yeah, mm-hmm.
Have they ever gone into how Reed and Sue met?
Yeah, and that was accurate. But one thing I did notice is that, and the original was a little kind of creepier. She was a good bit younger than he was. Like in this, you know, she's a college. They're both in college at the same time. Although, you know, he's like working on his third doctorate, so he's been in college a while. But I think in the original comics, he was like around 19, 20 when they first met. She was probably 14. And it was a little more, it had a little more creepy vibe
in the original. Yeah.
Than it did. But it wasn't like physical, you know, at the time. It was just like, you know, but that didn't come till later. But,
I
thought it, Charles Xavier was the creepiest character in the classic Marvel.
Well, if Xavier was like 40 at the time, so that was even creepier.
Like, I think, you know, what made me not, I'm not saying that I want to drop the book, but what made me like happy again, because, you know, I mentioned how the real appeal of the first issues was that there was some FF kids in it. I really did enjoy though how at the end of the flashbacks, Reed says why he's leaving, and he's not trying to be charming or, you know, or romantic. He's just being brutally honest.
Yeah, that's,
and
yeah.
Being an egghead. Oh, well, I have to leave because otherwise I'll just be thinking of you. And then she kisses him. Like, it was a good moment to me.
Yeah.
That was it kind of plays into like some of his obtuseness when it comes to stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was
very good. Yeah, he wasn't trying to make a comment. He was trying to, like, you know, say, oh, I'm not leaving because I don't care about you. I'm leaving because I have to do my work. Like work came first, but this time it worked for him. He got something out of it.
Yeah.
He got lucky. So, I enjoyed the issue.
Me too. Wasn't bad. We'll see what next week brings.
Every time a new issue of Fantastic Four comes out, I wonder to myself, okay, is Bird going to be mad at this because it's, again, a good issue?
Well, I'll say this. It's not – I feel like some of the earlier issues were a little bit stronger, so my hate was not as strong this week. You pleased me, Fraction, by making a semi-subpar effort. You live to see another week.
Alright. Is that all the books you guys want to mention?
I think so. Let me see.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything else.
I mean, I don't really have anything to say about Wolverine and the X-Men. I mean, it's Wolverine and the X-Men.
Yeah, it was pretty good. I did notice another comic book site reviewed it and gave it like 2 stars out of 5, talking about how bad and unstructured and purposeless. It didn't seem to have much in the way of purpose or storytelling. I was like, what the fuck are they talking about?
Yeah, I didn't that.
Did they read like the same book we read?
Yeah, that doesn't sound like this issue at all. Like, there's a story there. There's a structure.
It's just maybe not, I don't know what they were expecting exactly, so.
Yeah.
Maybe. But it had Wolverine and had the X-Men.
Yeah.
What more can you ask? It does what it says on the cover.
All right, so the first piece of news was posted by Matt in the group page.
Yes.
And it's about the fact that Geoff Johns, you know, after this current stuff that's going on, he's going to be finally stepping down from Green Lantern. And this is him concluding a pretty much like a 9-year run.
Yeah.
So kind of your, what's your thoughts on this whole thing?
Well, admittedly, I haven't been, especially since like after Blackest Night, I kind of fell off with Green Lantern just because I felt like Blackest Night was, you know, a fitting like a, you know, climax to what he was doing. But yeah, it surprised me when I read the article about it. I didn't realize how long he'd actually been on Green Lantern. You know, it was, like you said, 9 years. And pretty much, and I think most people agree, good or bad, I know there's, like, some of his work is kind of polarizing with some people. But I think he pretty much...
Justice League.
Yeah, Justice League. And also what he did with Green Lantern, he tried to apply it to Flash, and it was less successful. But
yeah.
I think not only that, but
what he did with Green Lantern in general.
Yeah, like, yeah, that was...
Not everyone was...
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, you either seem to love it or hate it for the most part. But I do think that he gave the series a well-needed shot in the arm. And,
yeah.
I mean, when they said, you know, was it Rebirth, that's what it literally was a rebirth of the Green Lantern Corps as, you know... it. Because prior to that, what, there were, like, supposed to be only 4 or 5 Green Lanterns at the most... before Hal Jordan come back, so it was nice to see the Green Lanterns, you know, become, because I think I'm going to take some heat for this, but it was because I'm not a big Kyle Rayner fan. I just always felt like Kyle Rayner was kind of a DC's version of Spider-Man, and Hal Jordan, for all his flaws about being boring and being a guy who likes to punch things all the time, as people like
to say.
He was
the only version of his personality, really.
Yeah, and I will, you know, see all that, but I don't think maybe what they did to Hal Jordan was necessary to, you know, relaunch the thing, but I think it went a long ways into making the books, you know, something as a whole, like, you know, having all 4 Earthlanders back in the saddle again really helped. And, you know, I mean, what can you say? You look at all the other crap he did besides, you know, Rebirth, you know. The War of
Sinestro,
Light.
Yeah, the Sinestro Corps.
Oh, yeah. The highlight, the best part of his run is the Sinestro Corps War. It really is.
Yeah. But that, the Sinestro Corps War, the War of Light, the Blackest Night, Brightest Day, even bringing back or bringing a brand new Green Lantern into the fold.
Simon Baz. I gotta say, that was, I think, what contributed to my surprise with it, because... He just introduced Simon Baz, so I was kind of shocked that he was going to leave that title now that he's introduced his own Lantern. But at the same time, you know, Simon Baz is going to be in Justice League of America. So I guess he'll still be tackling him. But I'm a little bit – I'm kind of mixed, whereas, like, I'm saddened because Geoff Johns honestly is the reason I got into Green Lantern – as much as I did, because while I always liked the character, and I liked, like, the first Lantern I ever knew was Kyle Rayner, so I liked that character, I was never really that big in the mythos or that big into the character of Hal Jordan until Johns brought him back and really kind of helped define him a bit more. So I've been keeping up with Green Lantern ever since. I kept up even longer than Matt did after Blackest Night. Like, I've read I would say a good majority of the issues since Blackest Night, and also since it relaunched with Sinestro and Hal, so I've been pretty thoroughly a fan, and I like, you know, the inclusion of Simon Baz and all that, so I don't really care if he's leaving at this point, because he's just done so much that, you know, what more can he do, really?
Mm-hmm.
So on that note, it's like I'm just kind of a mixed reaction. It's like I'm sad, but at the same time, it's like it makes sense.
Yeah, when I look at all the things that he has done with the Mythos, I think about, okay, what has he done? What did he not do? And what could be done? My only concern is not what could be done, not what he did do. It's what he didn't do, only because. Very small thing. He introduced all these new cores.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that I disliked certain issues that were mainly taken care of in Green Lantern New Guardians, but you know, one small subplot that's been happening in this whole Third War thing that I'm kind of surprised in a way that people have overlooked is that essentially a lot of the other cores have broken up or been taken or being taken out in a way. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's been so overlooked. And I don't know if maybe John should have done that himself as some more promoted thing, but I feel like maybe if he did write it though, it could have been more impactful for some reason. It's because, like, for instance, Blue Lanterns, their home planet was taken over by the Reach, and now St. Walker escaped with some other Lanterns. You know, Sinister Corps is completely disbanded. Only one that's left is Arkilo because the Weaponeer made him a new ring. It's kind of unstable. The Star Sapphire, also covered in Green Lantern New Guardians, they are plotting with the Guardians, but they're trying to double cross the Guardians, and the Guardians know that. So essentially, they're also going to lose their core in a way. The Red Lanterns, I can't speak for really because I haven't read the book. The Indigo Tribe, you know, we got all the information about them finally, and they're still existing. So that's one core to stick around. But the point is, like, I feel like one of the biggest things that he did was establish all these cores. Mm-hmm. It was. I mean, Sinister Corps War, the story that everyone talks about, that hinted at the idea of all those cores. Then you had the War of Light, which is basically about the forming of those cores. Then you had Blackest Night, which was those cores actively being used. And I feel like he should have been the one to write any type of disbandment with them.
Yeah.
And he didn't, so.
Yeah, I can see what you mean with that. And also, it's worth mentioning that when I think about all that he's done with his run on Green Lantern, not just with the other color cores, but with the characters, with introducing new characters, like members of those other cores, like Atrocitus and St. Walker, and I forget what her name is, the Indigo Tribe leader.
Indigo One.
Yeah, Indigo One. And you know, even bringing back Necron from Blackest Night. Like, when I think about it all, it's like, I think Geoff Johns has done more with Green Lantern than any other writer.
Yeah, he kind of, because granted, you know, as comic fans, you kind of hate the idea of a retcon. He retconned a lot of stuff in Green Lantern, but it kind of worked.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was for the better, to be honest. Like, I think Parallax, Fear, Demon type thing aside.
That's the hardest thing for all fans to agree on. That's the hardest thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I myself wasn't really a fan of that because I felt like it kind of took away from the character a little bit.
It was a bit of a cop-out. I agree.
Yeah. But that aside, like, I basically like everything he's done, like, in terms of, like, the plots and the ideas and the concepts. Like, I really love the idea of a color core because that made the Green Lantern universe insanely expansive. Like you can't really imagine a Green Lantern core anymore that's just the greens. Like, you think of all the other factions now. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he's left a legacy at the very least.
Yeah. And, yeah, I'll agree with what you said about what he did. I'll say what was his name? The guy who created the Silver Age Green Lantern concept, Gardner Fox, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, it's probably second only to him in terms of the Green Lantern mythos with what he did, the impact.
That is true. Because
created it all, he started it all.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah.
Well, the one thing I also thought about when this news came up, I don't know if it's been announced yet, but who do you think will take his place? And if someone does take his place, will they be like how he was with Green Lantern, with guiding the entire, you know, all the books and stuff, and the whole mythos of in the direction of where it goes?
It's a hard question.
Well, I mean, Pete Tomasi has been doing Green Lantern
Core, right?
Green Lantern Core, yeah. I was thinking Emerald Knights, but yeah, I think it is Green Lantern Core. I think maybe he would take over. I'm not sure because
he seemed like the natural choice.
I think he'd be the best replacement.
Yeah, probably. I mean, I haven't read much of his stuff, admittedly. Like, I've mainly read his Batman and Nightwing work.
I've read some of his early stuff with the Green Lantern Corps that when it was launched, and I really loved it just because of how the book focused less on the Earth Lanterns and there was more story. It had a much bigger cast and much more enjoyable characters and stuff as opposed.
Oh yeah, before the War of the Lanterns, I absolutely loved Tomasi's Green Lantern Corps. I loved it, but then War of the Lanterns came along. And I wasn't too fond of all the aspects of War of the Lanterns, and that's when I dropped off. And then when New 52 came out, I was happy that Guy was one of the main characters. But then the fact that John Stewart was the second main character and not Kyle Rayner, I'm sorry, I don't like John Stewart. I don't like him.
You so racist.
I didn't read the book. I literally stayed away from Green Lantern Corps because of John Stewart. I really did.
Yeah, John Stewart's one of the characters where it's like, I mean, can anyone really say he's their favorite Lantern?
Well, it's the fact that people say, oh, you know, why do you like Hal Jordan so much? He's so boring. He's like, he's not more boring than John Stewart.
hey.
No way in hell.
John Stewart was a Marine, and apparently he blew up a planet one time. So, I mean, come on.
He blew up Mogo.
Oh, yeah, before that, though. Didn't he blow up another planet?
I know.
I can't remember.
He did.
Yeah. So he's killed two planets. Come on, give a brother some credit. You got to.
I can't believe this. Bird defending a black man.
My anger stems from this. When Justice League cartoon came out, it had freaking John Stewart because they wanted a black character, and then they made Hawkgirl. I said it before, but you can argue all you want. They made her your token Hispanic chick, the one that's all angered and has so much passion because she's angry and shit.
And she also loved tacos.
Yes, that's true. It's that like they felt like, okay, we want to have a Green Lantern. Let's not put one of the fan favorites. Let's put a black guy so we can appeal to the black community. Let's make Hawkgirl kind of emulate Hispanic to somewhat appeal to the Hispanic community. Like, I don't give a shit about their race. I want the characters that I care about. Since then, I've hated them.
And not only that, but Hawkgirl was pretty much placed in there just to have another female besides Wonder Woman.
And the fact that they forced the whole relationship when I'm a Hawkman fan. You don't fuck with a guy's girl. That's like, there's a classic line that I think Kevin Smith said. He's like, he was talking about how, you know, Marvel came to him to write some Daredevil stories and they wanted him to use Elektra. He's like, nah, I'll write a story, but I'm not going to use Elektra. You know, that's Frank, you know, Miller's character. You know, you don't fuck your buddy's girl.
So you're not a fan of hot Thanagarian on African American action?
It's just that
I was the only one. Apparently, I was the only one who dug that relationship, I guess.
Yes.
Well, I mean, you dug it because it's kind of a self hate thing because
taboo.
Yeah, it's an interracial relationship.
Oh, you dirty, dirty Hulk girl. Oh, you dirty Hulk girl. You're so dirty.
You at age 9 saying that.
I was 12 when I watched that. Come on, get it right.
Fair enough.
But, yeah, so Geoff Johns. That aside.
Speaking of relationships.
Geoff Johns' relationship with Green Lantern is over. There.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Excellent segue, if I may say so myself, and I do.
So, you could say that in this week of Valentine's, we had a breakup in the comic industry.
Oh, we did. Yes, we did indeed. It was amicable, yep. I would assume, but I don't know.
Yes.
Well, I would assume the Green Lantern mythos get the house.
So, IGN posted an article saying, hey, that's my cape, you know, colon, long-lasting comic love. And before we get into it, I'm gonna post right now on the chat to be linked in the show later a YouTube clip for the listeners called Super Harmony. It's basically a dating site for superheroes and supervillains. It's hilarious. It's not like terribly terribly new, but it's still awesome, and it works with the Valentine's Day, and it works with the IGN article. And the IGN article, you know, there's no need to read anything about it. It's simply just talking about superhero relationships in the past. It really keys in on Catwoman, Batwoman, Catwoman, Batman, Spider-Man, Mary Jane, and Lois and Superman. But in general, you know, I figured, you know, it's Valentine's Day week, and maybe you guys wanted to mention past comic book romance characters and shit.
Well, I would say that my favorite romance, as I mentioned earlier, was the Hulk girl, John Stewart one from Justice League. So,
yeah, there was some like I'm trying to think of the characters, but do you ever have a like where you felt like it was kind of forced when they try to make them other than New 52 Superman Wonder Woman?
Yeah, I was gonna say.
One relationship I always thought was kind of creepy was the post One More Day was the Spider-Man Carly Parker one, just because
Carly Cooper,
yeah, just because she was named after Joe Quesada's daughter, you know. That was something always creepy about that. Yeah, that was his daughter's name. So apparently Joey Q wants Spider-Man as his son-in-law, maybe. I don't know.
Oh, you know.
Or his daughter has a thing for Spider-Man.
Well, I mean, she's like 6 or 7. I mean, I'm not talking about, yeah.
Wow, that's...
Why do you make yourself look creepy, away, Sergio?
I know, right?
Let's move away from this. Comic book relationships. One that I felt like was forced?
Yeah, or not forced, but I'm saying like if you have one that sounds forced, because I'm trying to think of one that I know bugged me, but I can't recall what it is right now.
I will say one that I think I'm not a fan of, but I think has gotten better over the issues. But the relationship from the only book that I read that no one else does is Red Hood and the Outlaws with Starfire and Roy Harper. But that was kind of forced, very forced if you read the first issue.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's gotten a little more tolerable, I think, maybe, because it's less Goldfish, Ho, Starfire in there. So, unfortunately, that's the whole reason I bought the book, and they turned away from it.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to say, speaking of Starfire, I've never, like, I tolerate it, but I've never really cared for the idea of Dick Grayson and Starfire. Like, for some reason, those two just never clicked as well as, like, Dick and Barbara.
Yeah, me too. I've always felt that way. To me, something more natural about.
Yeah, I know she's gonna kill us.
No, I thought that she preferred the Barbara and Dick.
I think she did.
Oh,
I'm thinking of the Corey one.
Yeah, I think I'm thinking of another friend of ours who prefers Starfire and Dick,
hardcore. I'm trying to think if there's anything else, but I'd agree with what Alex was saying about Batman, Dick Grayson and Barbara. They seem like they're better.
I have to say some of my favorite Batman and Catwoman moments, though, have to be, I really liked their interaction in Hush.
Oh, yeah.
I really loved the use of that when Paul Dini did those Hush stories, Heart of Hush and House of Hush.
Oh, yeah. That was, I'm not the believer that Bruce and Selina should ever, you know, get married or something like that. Or it kind of goes against their nature to be a couple in a way, because their love story is kind of, it's meant to be the, the forbidden fruit angle, where it's like, Bruce wants her, but he can't have her because she stands against everything he believes in. You know, she's a thief and a criminal, and even a killer, really, when she killed Black Mask. But at the same time, you know, he can't really deny his feelings for her. And I did love that moment in Heart of Hush that you were talking about, where he eventually breaks down and does profess his love. I thought that was a really good moment, even though I don't feel like, you know, they should ever become like a permanent thing or anything like that.
You're all right with the occasional rooftop banging as seen in Catwoman #1.
Yeah. To be honest, as much as people, you know, rag on that, I was never really.
Yeah, I was fine with it.
Yeah. You were into it big time.
Well, I mean, it was definitely no you know, liking of Hot Girl and Jon Stewart. Nah.
I think you secretly wish to be Catwoman in that, while you read that.
You know, okay. I think that everyone can gladly recall the classic Justice League Unlimited clip where Bruce is singing "Am I Blue?"
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, when Wonder Woman is turned to a pig, that was a very awesome episode and clip, and that was a romantic one. So, I gotta say, when Cornell came on board and announced that he was going to write Stormwatch number one and do that series, he was immediately asked about the whole Apollo and Midnighter relationship, and he said no, they won't be a couple yet, but I'm going to slowly establish and work towards it. And he definitely dabbled in it before he left the book, but he never truly got around to that because he left it or was taken off eventually. And I feel like, you know, that's a relationship that is kind of, I mean, like in the recent issues especially, the fact that, you know, they have feelings is definitely prevalent. You know, there's anger and tension and shit. But I feel like, I don't know, maybe they really did have a plan to slowly make it a legitimate relationship. But I feel like they should be a couple by now. I don't know.
Did either one of y'all read The Authority?
No.
Well, in The Authority, they're both at that point in their careers, they're together. You know, they're a couple, and I just thought The Authority did it real well with, you know, not trying to draw too much attention to the fact that they were a gay couple, and not trying to not talk about it at all. You know, they just seem like any normal, you know, couple who just happen to be superheroes and two dudes. But speaking of alternative lifestyles, The one of the most famous, implied anyway, alternative sexual couples would be Harley Quinn and Poison Ivy.
Yeah, yeah. To be honest, I always like when Paul Dini especially plays around with that mutual attraction.
Yeah, he likes that a whole lot, idea.
He's kind of a freaky dude.
I think we've talked about this before, but have you ever seen his wife?
Yeah, yeah, she's
she's a Tana. There's no way to get around it.
Yeah, she is a Tana, and not only that, but it's like even before he met her, like there are stories of him, you know, writing Zatanna stories, like he was in love with the character.
Yeah, so Paul Dini.
So maybe that's one of my favorite relationships, Paul Dini and Zatanna.
Yeah, I never really understood or accepted the small bit of young romance, I guess, or flirtation with Zatanna and Batman, though. I never accepted it, to be honest.
I kind of liked it as kind of like you said, like an infatuation and flirting, but I never really seen it too much as anything serious.
Yeah, I kind of see it the same way, where it's like it can never really be more than it is, just because they're two completely different people. Like, they're polar opposites in a way that I can't see it working, just because Zatanna's not really an inherently dark or torturous character. And, you know, Batman's more of someone who would attract more of a damaged person, like Selina or even Wonder Woman to an extent. I've always kind of liked.
It feels like Zatanna's more so, she likes more so the Bruce Wayne aspect than the Batman aspect.
Yeah. Who wouldn't? Come on.
You know. Well, no, I mean, like, as in, like, if they were like, you know, kids as friends type of thing.
I understand. But we talked a lot about DC. What about any other Marvel people? Because we briefly mentioned Spider-Man. What about the greatest Marvel love story of all time, which is, of course, Hank Pym and Janet Pym, you know. Make me some dinner.
Hey, there are also some issues of Fantastic Four where Reed backhanded.
Slapped on the butt. You're a woman. What do you know?
Yeah.
That's, I mean, there's like issues.
Men are talking.
From the early 60s, that's what it is. Like, you know, because like for some reason he becomes like Humphrey Bogart or something. Why don't you scram, dollface? The men are talking. Like, okay, that's...
This is getting kind of dark.
Yeah. Okay, Stanley, I didn't realize that's how you felt about women. But I'm trying to think, like, yeah, there's...
I did always like the aspect of Peter Parker and Gwen Stacy. Like, I liked that impact on his life. Like, it was his first love and his first tragic.
The only reason why I liked that, and that's why I think that Amazing Spider-Man explored it so well, is because she actually was a really smart girl.
Yeah, yeah. She was more compatible. Well, I don't really want to get into a thing because we're kind of running over time as it is. But
I do.
There are a lot of people who detract from Mary Jane and Peter Parker as a couple, and I have to say I disagree with them. I've always preferred MJ.
I do think that some of the thing is that the whole Gwen Stacy thing, as time went on, people have looked at the tragedy.
Forgot about her.
Not forgot about her, but they built it up. Writers over the years built it up into, like, put her on a pedestal, which led to the ultimate pedestal knockdown, which was Sin's Past, which was a delightful issue of old man on young woman, hot loving. Yeah, I love that. But
because she felt sorry for him.
Poor Osborn. Yeah, he got a pity lay.
Oh, JMS.
Who else? Let's see, there's Iron Man and insert Woman of the Week here.
I think Tony's best relationship is himself. Like, I think that's his big woman.
They explain all the mirrors in his house.
Yeah. I gotta mention, like, the ultimate power couple, Black Bolt and Medusa.
Oh, yeah, that was always cool just because of kind of the fact that he can't talk and they have, like, a bond that's more than words, you know.
Yeah. They
sound all sappy, but,
How does that work in the bedroom, though? Like he can't really do
foreplay. Like, oh, hey.
He can't, like, oh, the whole player dies.
Just imagine the things she can do with her hair. Come on, dude.
True.
Oh, and also, still on Marvel, the Cyclops and Jean Grey. They're supposed to be like the famous mutant couple, of course.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that they've cheated on each other a bunch of times. And she's died like 16 times, you know.
Yeah,
I always hated the whole Jean and Logan stuff. I always hated that.
I always kind of felt like they kind of undermined it. You know, the whole romance of Cyclops. And also,
it kind of just makes Wolverine to be a massive dick.
He's a home wrecker.
He's already supposed to be a dick, but at the same time, it's like he's supposed to be like a lovable dick.
That's what I didn't get. Like when I read Morrison's New X-Men with the whole thing about Scott and Emma Frost having like an affair inside their minds, and she's being portrayed as this horrible, you know, woman who's, you know, slut trying to break up their marriage, whatever they have. But, you know, it's all right for Wolverine to be chasing Jean around for, 20 years at this point, you know, telling her he loves her and all this crap. But, you know, as soon as Emma Frost does it, she's a homewrecker.
Yeah.
But Wolverine does it, and he's just, no one understands his pain.
Yeah. Well, you know.
It's hard being Canadian.
Chicks dig hairy dudes.
Yeah, I wish I could find that out firsthand, but I can't. He dropped
his broken headset. It's already broken and worn out.
I think Matt died.
I fell down some stairs. I'm sorry.
Show's over.
No.
Reed Richards pushed you down some stairs.
He found out I was pregnant. No, what it is minorities are coming to get me. No! Justice.
Justice.
But is there anything else that we haven't touched on that
I feel that perhaps we should move on to the last thing.
Okay. We've been going. This one's gonna be kind of long, so yeah.
Okay, I'm kind of surprised by it too. But it happens.
What was the last thing?
The Wonder Woman documentary on CBS or PBS. What is it?
PBS.
Yeah.
Is
Ken Burns doing it? That's what I want to know.
On April 15th, it's happening. And more so, this is kind of like something to lead into a question. You know, me personally, one of the main reasons why I buy DVDs is for the special features. Obviously, I love the movie. But, man, some movies have amazing special features. And they'll have the making of the movie, and then they'll have, like, source material if it's based off of a book or comic or something, you know. So when there's some movies that come out that have really, really good DVD commentary or DVD features with, like, backgrounds and interviews and such, that can either make me like, you know, be pissed at the producers or love them. And so for me, this is like that kind of aspect because, you know, I love to watch the Green Lantern special features or the Batman Begins ones. I was really pissed off that the Dark Knight had crappy ones.
Yeah.
I absolutely love watching those things, and this is basically like if one of those things. So kind of like, is there any type of comic story or superhero documentary that you would love to either buy or just watch, period, I guess?
I would like to see something like a documentary examining DC's
All Strangers Work.
I wasn't going to say that, but what I was going to say, it kind of ties in a little bit, but with DC's decision to do Crisis on Infinite Earths and essentially reboot the DCU and streamline as it is, like just interviews with the people who were in charge at the time. If I know some of them aren't alive anymore, but those who are still alive, and just see like the decisions that went into it and some of the background, and even tie in like how it would lead to the change of comics with, you know, guys like Alan Moore and Frank Miller, and how they were kind of changing how the narrative of the work was being presented. So I think that there's something worth examining there, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would definitely, like, taking that idea, there's actually lots of crossover events that DC has and Marvel, although they just weren't promoted as an event, there's this whole Eclipso one where basically the gems are scattered, and he appears in Superman, appears in Superboy, appears in Hawkman. He appears in all these different, you know, for this crossover event from the early 90s. You have Underworld also in the early 90s. You know, those type of things. I would love to see documentaries on those story arcs, you know. So, yeah, like kind of like start off with some of the Bronze Age stuff where you first had the Earth 1 and Earth 2 crossover stuff. I would pay money for a whole DVD or Blu-ray of just one story arc discussed after the other with detail as much as possible that you can get. I would pay good money for that.
I don't know if y'all remember it, but there was this documentary I watched one time on the History Channel. And it was Comic Book Superheroes Unmasked. I just looked it up. And it was a nice like retrospective from like the start of comic books up until what at the time was the present day. And it was well done. They had a lot of good interviews with – I remember there were people like Danny O'Neill, Frank Miller. I mean, just anybody – Stan Lee, anybody they could get, they talked to.
Yeah, and that was actually the first time I'd ever heard of the Frederick Wortham stuff. Mm-hmm. Like the Senate hearings in the 40s and the 50s.
Yeah, the book. Yeah, I forgot what it was called.
Seduction of the Innocent.
Yeah. Yeah, the Me Too, I think that was the first time I heard of that.
Where, you know, there was a psychology professor who, you know, thought comic books were evil and everything. But as far as, like, what a documentary I would want to see, I would say, I don't know. Like, to be honest, I feel like I've seen everything for characters and story arcs. And
there was one.
Well, there's been certain characters that haven't gotten a movie yet, so.
That is true. Like, I wouldn't mind seeing, like, a Flash documentary or a Wonder Woman documentary. I mean.
That you're getting at.
Yeah.
April 15th.
Yeah, pretty much.
There's one that I thought about was, Alex, you maybe know if they've made a documentary based on this or not. They probably have, but a documentary on the Adam West Batman show.
They've done so many Batman related documentaries.
Yeah, I figured that it's been mentioned in passing. It's about like just a whole thing dedicated.
Well, I was very surprised because of how old the movie is. I have the Batman 1960s movie, you know, and it has special features, and it actually has a lot of special features on it. So that's for any Bat fan, that's a really good buy. Like, there's actually interviews with Adam West and, you know, and all those other guys. Well, not all other guys, but a good deal of them, and lots of insight on the show on that time period. I was very impressed because, you know, it wasn't surprising that they had special features for this movie, but it's so old a movie that I thought that it would have been like, oh, you know, just a thing here, a thing there, and that's it. But no, pretty in depth stuff.
Hmm.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Yeah, I have that DVD. I haven't ever like tried any of the special features. I may do that actually.
Speaking of other documentaries, there's one that the news came out a couple weeks ago that the guy, he does a TV show, Metalocalypse on Adult Swim, was trying to get the money to do a documentary on Superman Lives, the ill-fated 1990s Superman movie that was going to be directed by Tim Burton and had Nicolas Cage in the part of Superman. That would be very interesting to see, you know, what went out, because really most of the stuff we know about it comes from Kevin Smith, who was the screenwriter of the film. And I would love to see, Kevin Smith, I think he's a cool guy. He does great storytelling. It's funny. But he can be kind of biased and one side on some of his opinions. So it would be good to see, an unbiased look at the whole thing to see, you know, what went wrong and why we should be thankful that movie was never made.
Yeah. I agree.
There was one documentary that I saw that was pretty cool. I say this because I'm not a huge Superman fan, so I don't always feel the need to, you know, read his stuff or watch his stuff. It's one where they literally analyze Superman and his powers, saying, okay, if this was the real world and we had real Kryptonians, how would it scientifically likely be possible for his physiology to allow these things? So it's like, oh, well, he has heat vision, so his islands would have to be like such. He can fight. He can fly, so you know certain parts of his body would anatomy would be like such. It was pretty cool. It was like a realistic way of analyzing it. How would this alien species exist? You know, so I would love to see it for all other superpower characters.
They actually did one about how Batman's gadgets would work in the real world.
I think I seen one about Spider-Man too, how like his webbing, like how strong you would have to be to support a full-grown man, not only to support him, but to be mobile and flexible
is. And swing around and all that.
Yeah, and I think the program I watched was The Science of Superheroes or something like that was what it was called.
That might have been it that I was watching, where this one was based on Superman solely.
Yeah.
But I can't really think of any others.
Well, my simple answer is that tackle every hero. Eventually, you'll get to all of them, and I will pay money for all of it. But obviously, I'm not the only target audience. But I can't get enough of that type of thing because, like I said, I am a huge fan of special features. I absolutely love it.
I'm surprised you didn't mention an Aquaman documentary.
Well, because that's kind of self-explanatory.
He can't really like something that he's already trying to produce.
Yeah, he's got a Kickstarter page out there, people. So go visit it.
Somehow it's donated minus something.
I steal money from it.
But, do you think that just about wraps it up?
Yeah, I say you can close this out, Alex.
All right, well, you have been listening to the Off-Panel Podcast featuring myself, Alex Cook, and Sergio Martinez, Matt Johnson. Say goodbye, gentlemen.
See you guys around. I have to go to my dad's birthday now.
Burn in hell, Martinez's. Enjoy your party.
Tune in, same time, same station. Don't miss it.
By the way, I should probably mention I won't be here next week. I'm actually going to look. Me and my mom are going to look at a house. We're thinking about moving.
we're going to look at houses that we could go door to.
Yeah. Scouting. Now I think about it, you go up to the house, you're ready to knock, and all of a sudden, the Mormons jump up. What are you doing? This is our turf. It becomes
a gang war.
You, flash, the West Side sign. Witness, son. Witness. They do it upside down. Mormons.
We take out guns.
Watchtower versus the Book of Mormon.
The Sharks and the Jets.
We get shot. We don't want to spill any blood.
Everyone breaks out into song.
No. What it is your threats. We don't spill our blood, but you know our Bible said nothing about spilling other people's blood.
It's nothing about spilling yours. Oh God.